And Brother Dan, title of Brother Dan's discourse is Israel, Lesson in History. Israel, Lesson in History. So, Brother Dan.
Thank you, brethren. Hopefully we won't put you to sleep after you had such a nice lunch. But we thought, in keeping with the spirit of the convention, which is looking at these prophecies and where we are on the stream of time and kind of trying to gauge, you know, the progress of things, it would be good to look at some of the history surrounding the establishment of the nation of Israel. We are also going to look back a little further than 1874 to start out with, because really, in a sense, Israel is sort of a major timeline or a major measurement to help us understand the plan. So many things surround it, you know. So let's begin by looking back. We're going to go all the way back to the time of the division of the land. Or even before that, where did the city of Jerusalem come from? You know, according to Jewish tradition, and this is out, you can actually find this on the History of Jerusalem on the Jerusalem website, the capital of Israel. Jerusalem, according to Jewish tradition, is mentioned in the Torah as the city of Salem. Abraham, who met Melchizedek, king of Salem, received a blessing from him there. Rabbi David Kimchi, a medieval Jewish commentator, explains that Salem refers to Jerusalem, which was a place of Zedek. Well, that's part of Melchizedek's name, Melchizedek. And he says, righteousness, which means righteousness, and Salem, peace. And this is, we can see this mentioned in Genesis 14, 18, and Psalm 76, verse 2. Now, the Midrash, which means exposition, is a explanatory works on the Tanakh, and based on Genesis 22:14, teaches that Abraham brought his son to be sacrificed there, and Abraham called the place, God will be seen, Yireh, and Melchizedek called it Salem. Therefore, say the sages of Israel, we call the city Yireh Salem, or Jerusalem. The city of Salem is the place where the presence of God will be seen. When the holy temple will be rebuilt, and is also the place which will bring peace to all mankind. The name of Jerusalem is mentioned more than 600 times in the Hebrew Bible. So even though this city existed, it didn't really gain a lot of real importance till later. And it's not until the division of the land that the city of Jerusalem actually comes into the hands of the nation of Israel. Jerusalem was part of the portion of land given to the tribe of Judah, Joshua 15:63, and the tribe of Benjamin, Joshua 18:21-28, see verse 28 in particular, and taken from the Jebusites, which both Benjamin and Judah failed to drive out completely. It is therefore suggested that Zion's hill was part of Judah and Moriah was part of Benjamin's portion. In reprint 1648, we read, the name Zion was anciently applied to a prominent hill of Jerusalem, generally regarded as the southwestern and highest of those on which the city was built. It included the most ancient part of the city, with the citadel, and being first occupied for a palace, it was called the City of David, 2 Chronicles 5:2. It was also called the Holy Hill, or Hill of the Sanctuary, Psalm 2:6. Being the original site of the tabernacle pitched by David for the reception of the ark. By the prophets, the name was often put for Jerusalem itself, and also for its inhabitants, speaking of the Hill of Zion, sometimes called sons or daughters of Zion. It was also used in a wider sense, as was Jerusalem, also to signify the entire nation of Israel. And since fleshly Israel was typical of spiritual Israel, the gospel church, the symbolism applies with still deeper significance to the gospel church, which term throughout the gospel age included the entire body of professed Christians, all of whom are on probation for full membership in the church triumphant, the true church, the Zion of the future, and the true Zion of the present age, the elect little flock to whom it is the Father's good pleasure to give the kingdom. Also found in reprint 1296, there was a letter, and we're only going to quote part of it. It says, Jerusalem is situated on elevated ground south of the center of the Holy Land, about 33 miles from the Mediterranean Sea, and about 19 miles from the River Jordan. From the time it was called the City of David, according to 2 Samuel chapter 5, 6 through 9, where the storming of its fortress by David is given, it also became the religious and political center of the typical kingdom by the divine great King Jehovah's appointment, 1 Kings 11:36. And we're going to read this. And unto his son will I give one tribe, that David my servant may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen myself to put my name there. And what did we find that Jerusalem meant? God will be seen. After the division of the tribes, the city of David continued for a time to be the capital of the kingdom of Judah, though several times plundered, until at length it was made desolate at the Babylonish captivity. That's the end of the quote there. The certainty of the promises of the coming blessings given to Israel is clearly pointed out in the following scriptures. Now we're going to jump forward a little bit. Zechariah 8:14-15. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, as I thought to punish you when your fathers provoked me to wrath, saith the Lord of hosts, and I repented not, so again have I thought in those days to do well unto Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Fear ye not. So just as certainty as they were to go through punishments, and they did, just as certain they will be blessed. And again, in Jeremiah 32:42, for thus saith the Lord, like as I have brought all this great evil upon this people, so will I bring upon them all the good that I have promised them. And Paul reasserts this in Romans 11:28-29, that regarding their blessing, he says, as concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sake, but as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake, for the gifts and calling of God are without repentance. Now, we as Bible students have learned from the scriptures that Israel does play a central role in the plan of the ages for the blessing of all mankind. For example, their laws and ceremonies were types and shadows of things to come in the plan of God. From them will be selected a faith class, a remnant, which will be heavenly, and a special class, which will be princes in all the earth, which we denominate the ancient worthies. Also, the promise to Abraham is to his seed as the stars of heaven, the heavenly class made up of the little flock, the bride of Christ, and the broader church of the firstborn, inclusive of the great company, and as the sands of the seashore, the earthly seed, which include not only the ancient worthies and the nation of Israel, but will eventually include all who will be blessed under the new covenant, for they too must become Israelites and become part of the seed class. In addition, certain prophetic timelines are associated with Israel, and Brother Bill shared some of that with us this morning, including the parallel, looking at the parallels, and also the times of the Gentiles, both of which point to a change in Israel's blessing, toward Israel's blessing. The end of each point chronologically adds special favors and blessings to God's people. The full blessing and favor will not return to Israel until, as mentioned in Romans 11:25, when the fullness of the Gentiles will be come in. That is, the full number of those selected to be his bride from amongst the Gentiles has completed their course. Then their blindness will be removed as a result of the finality of Jacob's troubles, which will take away the stony hearts and give them a heart of flesh, on which can be written the law of God under the new covenant arrangement. You know, the time of trouble is really an act of love on the part of our Heavenly Father for the very purpose of preparing man's hearts that he may bless them. Jeremiah 31:33, "But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." Recalling our studies, we have laid out for the first of these time periods, called the Jewish double, in which there are two equal periods, one of favor to Israel and the other of disfavor, or a period in which they were cast off from God's special favor and dealings directly with them. The period of favor began with Jacob's death, where the sons of Jacob and their families are first called by their national name, that is, the 12 tribes of Israel, as found in Genesis 49:28. It is a period lasting 1845 years, ending when they were cast off by the master in 33 AD. Then comes the second or equal portion of time of their period of disfavor, beginning from the time of their casting off, followed by 1845 years of trouble and punishment until 1878 AD, at which time we should expect to see a marked change in God's dealings with natural Israel. From thenceforth, 1878 and onward, would be fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah already referred to, Isaiah 41:2. Comfort ye my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her, for her warfare, hardship, or appointed time is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double, kephal, or duplicate, for all her sins. And Psalm 102:13 tells us, "Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for it is time to have mercy upon her, for the set time is come." And we use the Brenton's English Septuagint translation there. It is from this time forward we should expect to see fulfillment of those promises of a return to the land of Israel, a reestablishment of them in their land. And so let us consider a few of these promises and note the words of Isaiah found in the 11th chapter. First of all, verses 1 through 10 are a picture of the time of the Lord's presence and the establishment of the kingdom. But we want to focus on verses 11 and 12. Isaiah 11 and 12. "And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again, the second time, to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria and from Egypt, from Pathros, from Cush and from Elam, and from Shinar and from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." Note the words, "It shall come to pass in that day." That is, in the day of his presence, in the day of judgment, during the time when his kingdom is being established, he will regather the Jewish people back into their land. It's a sign of the times of restitution. Jeremiah 24:6. "For I will set mine eyes upon them for good, and I will bring them again to this land, and I will build them and not pull them down, and I will plant them and not pluck them up." And Jeremiah 16:14-15. "Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that it shall no more be said that the Lord liveth that brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but that the Lord liveth that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north, and from all the lands whither he had driven them. And I will bring them again into their land that I gave unto their fathers." Peter tells us in Acts 3 that all God's holy prophets speak about the times of restitution. And much of the restitution of which they speak is the restoration of Israel. We have mentioned several prophecies in Isaiah and Jeremiah, but as has been heard, there's the prophecies in Ezekiel, Joel, Amos, Hosea, Micah, Zephaniah, and Zechariah, as well as other places in the Old and New Testament. Well, prior to 1878, there were Jews in Palestine, but they were only 2% of the population of the land. Ownership was restricted due to policies of the Ottoman Empire, of which Palestine was a part. But this was about to change. Volume 2, page 218. The Jew is now permitted privileges in Palestine denied him for centuries past, and it was in that very year, 1878 A.D., when their double was full and God's favor was due to return to that people, that the Berlin Congress of Nations was held, in which Lord Beaconsfield, a Jew, then Prime Minister of England, was a central figure and took the leading part. There, England assumed a general protectorate over the Asiatic provinces of Turkey, among which is Palestine. And the Turkish government amended its laws relating to aliens, which greatly ameliorated the condition of the Jews then residing in Palestine, as well as partially opened the door for others to locate there with the privilege of holding real estate. Previously, the Jew was but a dog to be cuffed, kicked, and abused by the Mohammedan ruler, and was denied the most ordinary privileges of existence in the land sacred to him with memories of the past and with promises touching the future. Another significant aspect of this year is that Lord Beaconsfield, otherwise known as Benjamin Disraeli, was Prime Minister of England, the only Prime Minister to ever be of Jewish descent, either before or after, and we'd say even until our day. And at this time was when England assumed the protectorate over Palestine. Volume 3, page 261. England, by treaty with Turkey, became protector of the Asiatic province in the language of the historian Justin McCarthy. The English government undertook to guarantee to Turkey her Asiatic possessions against all invasion, formally pledged herself to defend and secure Turkey against all invasion and aggression, and occupied Cyprus in order to have a more effectual vantage ground from which to carry on this project. It will be seen then that Palestine, as one of the Asiatic provinces, is already under England's care, and this accounts for the greater laxity on the part of the Turkish government in the enforcement of its laws unfavorable to Jewish interests, unquote. Now, additionally, in the same year, as though to inaugurate a new era, a new agricultural settlement was started, and it called itself Petah Tikva, or Door of Hope. This seemed to mark this date as a call to the Jew that the door of opportunity to return to their homeland in fulfillment of the providences of God was wide open. Now, the name Petah Tikva was chosen by its founders from Hosea 2:17, where it reads, "And I will give her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor for the opening of hope, and she shall sing there as in the days of her youth, and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt," unquote. Now, originally, these pioneers intended to settle in the Achor Valley, near Jericho, and they purchased the land in that era. However, the Sultan, Abdul Hamid II, canceled the purchase and forbade them from settling there. But they continued to retain the name Petah Tikva, and purchased instead a modest amount of land, of which the Sultan approved, near the source of the Yarkin River. And as you recall, it was near a lot of swamp land as well, so it wasn't the best choice of land. All of this marked a turning point in Jewish aspirations. The first Aliyah, called the Farmer's Aliyah, was the first modern widespread wave of Zionist Aliyah, Aliyah meaning immigration, of Jews who immigrated to Palestine. In this wave came mostly from Eastern Europe and from Yemen. And this wave of Aliyah began around 1881, 1882. and it lasted until about 1903. And an estimated 23,000 to 35,000 Jews emigrated. A second Aliyah was important and highly influential, and that took place around 1904 and 1914, during which approximately 40,000 Jews emigrated into Ottoman Palestine, mostly from the Russian Empire and from Yemen. Now, these were primarily as a result of persecutions going on in Russia and Romania at the time. And, of course, it naturally caused them to even long more for their own land. And these longings are expressed by the psalmist in Psalm 137, 1-6. We're just going to read 5 and 6 in particular. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. In Jeremiah, we see a prophecy showing what transpired as to how they began to take possession of the land. And this is found in Jeremiah, the 32nd chapter, verses 43 and 44. And fields shall be bought in this land, whereof ye say, it is desolate, without man or beast. It is given into the hand of the Chaldeans. Men shall buy fields for money and subscribe evidences and seal them and take witness in the land of Benjamin and in the places about Jerusalem and in the cities of Judah and in the cities of the mountains and in the cities of the valleys and in the cities of the south, for I will cause their captivity to return, saith the Lord. In reprint 84, we find that a statement about Baron Rothschild, who at the time of the last loan of 200 million, I'm not sure if these are francs or sterling, pounds of sterling, was made to Turkey in connection with the war they were fighting at the time. But he accepted a mortgage on the whole of Palestine. That was the guarantee for the loan. Also, from an article titled, How Did the Zionists Acquire Land in Palestine?, and you can find this on PalestineFacts.org, says, we take the following excerpt. The Jewish National Fund was originally proposed in 1847, but you see, that was too early. It had to wait till the Fifth Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, in 1901 to really become a reality. The Jewish National Fund was established to buy land in Palestine for reclamation and Jewish settlement. The JNF required its first parcel of land, 800 acres, in Hedera. Other modest purchases were made in 1904 and 1908 in the Lower Galilee Valley of Judea and the Lake Kinneret region. And during this time, two forms of settlement that would prove crucial in the land acquisition enterprise were pioneered there: the cooperative called Moshav and the collective, Kavutsa or Kibbutz. Baron Benjamin Edmund James de Rothschild, 1845 to 1934, was enlisted in this cause after being partitioned by the leaders of one settlement, Rishon LeZion, one of the first Aliyah villages. His patronage embraced 12 settlements at all three levels of land redemption: purchase, reclamation, and economically viable settlements. The best known settlements sponsored by Rothschilds are Metula. I'm not going to read these because they're just too hard to read. But they were an example of a purchase that had the further advantage of controlling water sources and establishing the northern limit of a Jewish settlement. In 1900, Rothschild transferred the settlements, their agricultural enterprises, and 25,000 hectares of land to the Jewish Colonization Association. Now, when you think of 25,000 hectares, a hectare is about 10 acres, so that's quite a bit of land. In the military biography of Moshe Dayan, the early Zionist activity is described this way. Quote, using Rothschild's money, these Jews purchased land from absentee Turkish landlords to the Arab, and so to the Arab tenant farmers, the transfer of land from Turkey to Jewish ownership was of little consequence, since the Jews rehired them as agricultural workers. So they lost nothing. in the transaction. By the time Israel became a state in 1948, the JNF, the Jewish fund that we were just talking about, owned 12.5% of all the land of Israel. And on this 12.5% resided 80% of Israel's population. They live there now. With this ownership came the responsibility of transforming the land into a beautiful and fertile area that would be a suitable home for a new state. Now think of it. They did not steal that land. In fact, they paid exorbitant prices for it. As it turned out, as Israel turned swamps into gardens, it attracted more Arabs for jobs and to take advantage of the benefits of the region. The increasing immigration by the Arab was often more than the Jews, but not with the intent of developing the land, but rather to take advantage of the increased prosperity created by Jewish settlements and communities. In October 1910, Brother Russell spoke to a mass Jewish audience of 4,000. And we believe this was in fulfillment of prophecy found in Ezekiel 37, 3-5, and Ezekiel 37, 9-10. We read, "And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Lord God, thou knowest. Again he said unto me, Prophesy upon these bones, and say unto them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord God unto these bones, Behold, I will cause breath to enter into you, and ye shall live. Then said he unto me, Prophesy unto the wind. Prophesy, son of man, and say to the wind, Thus saith the Lord God, Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain, that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me. And the breath came into them, and they lived and stood upon their feet an exceeding great army." We'd like to quote a little bit from his address to the Hippodrome. Brother Russell states, "What in view of this is the lesson of the hour? Is this, my dear friends, that we should seek justice and not merely seek the land of Palestine?" I'm sorry, I misread that. "It is this, my dear friends, that we should seek justice and not merely seek the land of Palestine. I may say here that it is not at all my conception of the Bible teaching that 8 millions of Jews in the world are going to Palestine, even though it has been estimated that under the most favorable conditions, the land could support more than twice that many. It is my thought that some of your most earnest and saintly people will go to Palestine quickly, and that the rejuvenation there will be astonishing to the world. We have no thought whatever that it is God's plan respecting the Jews that all Jews will return to Palestine, but that the time has come when it is the duty of every Jew who is not going to Palestine personally to give his sympathy, to do all in his power to help every Jew that does desire to go there, and should be especially desirous of assisting financially those of the Jews who are now suffering in Russia, helping them back to Palestine and establishing their great enterprises." Sister Kathy is reading a biography on Brother Russell, and I think she mentioned to me that he had written to some of the wealthier Jews, encouraging them to assist and buying land of Palestine. Whether they listened to him or not, they certainly, some of them took advantage, particularly the Rothschilds. Other bankers did as well. Continuing with Brother Russell's statement here, he says, "We have come to the very time, dear friends, when the realization is to come in, when the promises given to the Word of God, to your race, are about to take hold upon you as a people and fire your hearts as never before. They say, as some have said to me, Pastor Russell, those who are interested in Zionist movement are only the poor. The rich of our people do not seem to be interested in it at all. I know nothing of that matter, dear friends, but I have to say, If my understanding of the matter is right, the voice of Moses is going to the rich, the leaders of the Jewish people. The very foundation of your national character is laid in your religion. And whatever touches your religion and your religious sentiments and your faith in God and your faith in the promises made to Abraham, that is going to stir you as a nation as nothing else has ever stirred you. I believe that we have come to the time, the set time, in which God will restore Zion. And that's the end of the quote. So the pastor did prophesy as was instructed. In the third volume forward, Brother Russell states concerning the restoration of Israel was not being accomplished as rapidly as expected. Concerning those who returned, he states, the returning ones represent those fullest of faith in the Lord and his promises, and doubtless will be dealt with as representatives of the whole. We remind our readers that when this volume was written, the Jews themselves had little thought of going to Palestine. Now Zionism has sprung up and has taken a deep hold upon the hearts of the Israelites. Although it was a secular Zionism at first, it has gradually turned to religious sentiment and hope. End of quote. Of course, the foreword was written in 1916, and things didn't progress as well as the pastor expected. But we know that in the Lord's plan, things are progressive, and things take a little longer than perhaps even our anticipations and some of our interpretations of prophecy. By 1916, there were between 50 and 60,000 in Palestine. Brother Russell further pointed out at the Hippodrome audience that the time of the Gentiles was about complete, and the time of the return of the kingdom of Israel was due in 1914. Again, 1914 came and there was no kingdom of Israel, but we know that the kingdom will be established with the antitypical David. And that's, of course, at a future point. He then pointed to the providences of God in appointing Dr. Herzl, and through his efforts, the attention of the whole world has been attracted to Palestine and to the Jews and the original covenant. End of the Gentile times did come, and it was time for Jerusalem and Israel to no longer be trodden down of the Gentiles. This was the next blessing that was to turn to Israel as a result of the time features. Luke 21:24 has already been read in previous lessons. When the war broke out, Turkey sided with the Central Powers, which were made up of Germany, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire itself, which is Turkey, and Bulgaria. And they allied themselves against the Allied Powers, which were made up of Britain, France, Italy, the U.S., and Russia. And one of the main fronts of the war was fought in Asia, primarily between Britain and the Ottomans. Now, we often think of World War I as taking place primarily in France, you know, as a result of maybe the book All Quiet on the Western Front or some of the other references to the history and the stalemate that was fought there. But this wasn't so much a stalemate fought here in the Asiatic provinces. No, God was doing something here. World War I was the beginning of the loosing of the winds that would eventuate in Israel becoming a nation. Remember, he prophesied to the wind, breathe on those slain. During the World War I and the war in Palestine, the Balfour Declaration was written. And this is a letter written by the British Foreign Secretary, Arthur James Balfour, to Lord Rothschild, the head of the Zionist Federation in Britain. It's interesting, and here's what it says. This is a portion of it. I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Certainly the interests of the British had less to do with establishing a home for the people of Israel and more to do with the interests of the British Empire. But the interest of Jehovah was in the fulfillment of his promise to them for the Father's sake and for the blessing of all the families of the earth. One of the generals who was leading the British armies and the one who was fighting the Ottomans in the Asiatic province was General Allenby. And on December 9, 1917, when he was about to attack the city of Jerusalem, Jerusalem surrendered without a battle. Allenby marched into the city on December 11th. It is also interesting to note that in Britain's battle plan against the Turks, they chose to start the attack in Basra. And as it turned out, the decisive battle was fought at Megiddo. And I thought that was interesting because it seemed to be sort of a microcosm of the expectation of the time of trouble. Begins with Basra, the wine press. Now, there's an article that was written called The Middle East During World War I by Professor David R. Woodward. And it's out there on the internet, and it was last updated March 10th, 2011. David Woodward is a professor of history at Marshall University in West Virginia. And he was writing for the site for BBC History. And so we're going to quote. The Ottoman Turkish army, some 600,000 troops, divided into 38 divisions, was of an unknown quality. But with Germany as an ally, the Ottoman Empire represented a serious threat to the British Empire. So in a preemptive strike, London immediately landed an Anglo-Indian force at Basra near the estuary of the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. This was done to protect the Anglo-Persian oil pipeline, which was vital to the British Navy, and to show the Union Jack in this strategically important area in the Persian Gulf. Later on in the article, he says, Allenby returned to the offensive at the Battle of Megiddo on September 19, 1918, with a decided advantage in manpower, artillery, air power, and morale, and assisted by Arab allies on his flank, he quickly destroyed the Ottoman Turkish armies facing him. That was the decisive battle. And once the enemy front was broken, the EEF, or Egyptian Expeditionary Force, as they were called, the cavalry, dominated the campaign. Damascus fell on October 1st, Aleppo, the last city to fall in the campaign, on the 26th of October. 5 days later, an armistice was signed with the Ottoman Empire, and the armistice came into effect. The war ended with the British occupying the territory that was to become Iraq, Palestine, Transjordan, Syria, and Lebanon, unquote. That's the end of the quote. I thought it strange, or maybe his prejudice was showing a little bit. Israel's not mentioned in that list. And this was published in March of this year. But he mentioned Iraq, Syria, Lebanon. Okay, turning to Zephaniah 3:8, we read, Therefore wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. After the war, the League of Nations was formed. The covenant establishing the League was part of the Treaty of Versailles. The aims of the League were to promote international cooperation and to achieve international peace and security. It failed miserably. The next 30 years would prove one of the most tumultuous. And the League of Nations would be replaced by the United Nations after the war, Second World War. But this league officially opened for business in January 1920. Now, recently in the news, There is much discussion and debate on the legal basis for Israel's right to the land. As part of the basis for the legal argument concerning this right, they reference the San Remo Conference held at Villa de Vacchan in San Remo, Italy. And this was held April 18th to the 26th, April 1920. The conference was a gathering of the Supreme Council of the Allied Powers, who met with the intent to decide the future of the Middle East following the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. In accordance with Woodrow Wilson's 14th points, it was not the intent of the victorious Allies to acquire new colonies in the area, but rather to establish there a new sovereign states over the course of time. The League of Nations, via this conference, divided the territory, formerly under the Ottoman rule and currently under British control, into new entities called mandates. The mandates would be administered like trusts by the British and French under supervision of the League until such time as the inhabitants were believed by the League members to be ready for independence and self-government. The mandate territories were Syria and Lebanon awarded to France, Iraq awarded to Britain, and a new entity called Palestine, which was also placed under British control. Palestine is defined for the first time in modern history, included the land on both sides of the Jordan River, and encompassed the present-day countries of Israel and Jordan. And that is found in the Concise History of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, pages 33 and 44. This area identified Palestine was soon to be redefined. In March 1921, the British Colonial Secretary Winston Churchill convened a high-level conference in Cairo to consider Middle East policy. As a result of these deliberations, they subdivided Palestine mandate along the Jordan River and the Gulf of Aqaba. The eastern portion they called Transjordan and was to have a separate Arab administration operating under the general supervision of the commissioner. At a follow-up meeting in Jerusalem with Churchill, High Commissioner Herbert Samuel, and Lawrence, Abdullah agreed to abandon his Syrian project in return for the emirate and a substantial British subsidy. A British government memorandum in September 1922 called the Churchill White Paper, approved by the League of Nations Council, specifically excluded Jewish settlement from the Transjordan area of the Palestine Mandate. The whole process was aimed at satisfying wartime pledges made to the Arabs. We now turn to Jeremiah 16:16. Behold, I will send many fishers, saith the Lord, and they shall fish them. And after I will send many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain, from every hill, out of the holes of the rocks. Now, we've already discussed the fishers in this prophecy as relating to the Zionist movement. After all, they held out the bait, which attracted mostly the religious element. That is the opportunity to buy land in the land of their land of promise. Now, the World War had other consequences. It resulted not only in the toppling of the kings of Europe, but it also resulted in great financial costs, which eventually led in some countries to depression and allowed the seeds of socialism to spread. And this it did do in Europe, started to do in Europe. The revolution had already taken place in Russia in 1917. And so the political landscape was greatly altered, which marked very clearly the end of the old order. The Vatican was very much opposed to the spread of communism. They were doing everything they could to halt the advance of socialism in Europe. They didn't want the same thing to happen to Europe that happened in Russia. And in the process, they aligned themselves with fascism, the autocratic forms of government which were much more in line with the Vatican view of the world, and particularly the view that the Catholics held at that time, which was that they were trying to reestablish their control as they once held it in Europe. So in 1929, they signed the Lateran Treaty with the Italian government. The agreement included a political treaty which created the state of the Vatican City. It gave them back temporal power, which they had lost in 1870 from Victor Emmanuel. And it guaranteed full and independent sovereignty to the Holy See. The Pope was pledged to neutrality in international relations and to abstention from mediation in controversy unless specifically requested by all parties. The Concordat established Catholicism as the religion of Italy. The financial agreement was accepted as settlement for all claims of the Holy See against Italy arising from the loss of their temporal power in 1870. Now, we make a note here that in 1984, Italy and the Vatican updated the provisions of the 1929 Pact, which included the end of Roman Catholicism as the formal state of religion. That was 1984. But the Vatican, the Lateran Treaty, is still in effect. The money received from this treaty, however, became the source of the Vatican's wealth today. And today they are worth billions, for they invested that money in land and properties and other investments. At the time of the signing of the treaty, Mussolini was Prime Minister of Italy and the leader of the National Fascist Party, which was ardently anti-communist. Again, in 1933, the Vatican signed a concordat with Germany, where Hitler was Chancellor and head of the Nazi Party, also fascist and also anti-communist. According to the book Hitler's Pope, part of the opposition to communism was due to, in part, to the fact that some of its key leaders were Jewish. And we know also that the writer of the Communist Manifesto was Jewish, Karl Marx. The effect on Jews in Europe was devastating. While controversy rages on the role of papacy during this period, it is evident that at the very least, they turned a blind eye to the systematic destruction of the Jews in Europe. And what is likely, they were very much complicit in the crimes. In 1939, more trouble for Israel or the Jewish people. The British White Paper called for the establishment of an Arab state in Palestine, the remainder of Palestine, remember, within 10 years. And for limiting Jewish immigration to no more than 75,000 over the following 5 years. Afterward, no one would be allowed in without the consent of the Arab population. So they went exactly against their mandate. Meanwhile, the policies on immigration in other countries were tightening. They put further pressure on the people of the book. Yet in spite of all this, at the end of the Second World War, and by the time Israel declared their independence in 1948, the Jewish population grew to 600,000. While this is a fraction of those who lost their lives in Nazi Europe, it is 10 times the amount that had returned under the more favorable period between 1878 and 1918. In the last 63 years, the population has increased to approximately 6 million, not including a 1.5 million Arabs living within their borders. So they went from 2% to over 70% of the population. Whatever the motivations of the earthly governments, as Bible students we know that God's plan will not fail. With every conflict and social upheaval, Israel has gained at least incrementally. In 1947, the UN partition plan reduced the remaining portion of Palestine, which was 25% of the original mandate, by an additional 44%. And it excluded Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria. The Jews accordingly, accepted. They wanted their nation. This was their chance. While all the Arabs refused, threatening war. So Israel accepted this proposal, this resolution 181, which was made in November of 1947, and it states in its own Declaration of Independence the following: Accordingly, we members of People's Council, representatives of the Jewish community of Eretz Israel and of the Zionist movement, are here assembled on the day of the termination of the British mandate over Eretz Israel, and by virtue of our natural and historic right, and on the strength of the resolution of the United Nations General Assembly, hereby declare the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Israel to be known as the State of Israel. In 1948, when Israel declared their independence, the overwhelming enemies which surrounded her attacked the fledgling nation. By war's end, Israel had increased the territory under their control by an additional 21% of the land over what was partitioned. They gained not only additional territory, but they also gained West Jerusalem. For the first time in almost 2,000 years, part of Jerusalem was back in the hands of Israel. East Jerusalem, along with Judea and Samaria, the so-called West Bank, remained under the control of Jordan. For 30 years, England occupied Jerusalem and was given a mandate to ensure a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. Their concern for oil and prejudice resulted in England's dealing treacherously with the Jews, the Jewish people, and their aspirations. And under the mandate, it became a burdensome stone. The British army could bring down the Ottoman Empire, but they were powerless against the increasing progress of the incoming kingdom and the establishment of the State of Israel. Again, threatened by her Arab nations, Israel found themselves fighting other wars, 1956 and again in 1967. But it was in this latter conflict they liberated not only the remaining portion of Palestine west of the Jordan, but inclusive of Jerusalem. They also returned to the Golan Heights, the Gaza, and occupied the Sinai. The ensuing political wars resulted in them negotiating away portions of these territories. Nevertheless, they are in possession of most of the land of promise. You're rapidly running out of time here. In Daniel 2:44-45, it speaks of the days of these kings, and speaks of the stone cut out of the mountain and breaking the image. The stone cut out of the mountain here is the true Zion, the church. In 1878, the sleeping saints, the bulk of the heavenly seed, were resurrected, and ever since each saint proves their faith, they are raised in a moment of a twinkling of eye. But the burdensome stone mentioned by Zechariah will become the earthly representative of the heavenly kingdom of God. In Zechariah 12:3, we read, "And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all the people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered against it." One authority describes this burdensome stone as a stone of offense, and this is according to the Targum, which is an Aramaic translation of the Tanakh. Another authority says it was a custom in Palestine to test the strength of youths by lifting up a massive stone. The phrase, "burden themselves with it," refers to this custom. Every effort to prevent Israel from becoming a nation, every effort to remove Israel, any nation that does so is assured to be cut to pieces. We wanted to mention also that in October 2010, the Vatican Synod was held. And the result of that synod, I want you to hear these statements that they made. They said, "The Holy Scriptures cannot be used to justify the return of the Jews to Israel and the displacement of the Palestinians, to justify the occupation by Israel of Palestinian lands." He further said, this archbishop, he says, "We Christians cannot speak of the promised land as an exclusive right for a privileged Jewish people. This promise was nullified by Christ. There is no longer a chosen people. All men and women of all countries have become the chosen people." Completely ignoring the scriptures. We're going to close with some scriptures, because as watchmen, we want to watch what's going on. And, you know, this month, the PA, the Palestine Authority, is going before the UN to bid for a Palestinian state. Their desire and their goal initially is to have Jerusalem as their capital. And then, of course, what they really want to do is drive Israel into the sea. So we're going to close with some scriptures. Zechariah 12:2-3. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And we believe that Israel is under siege even now. Isaiah 51:20-23. Thus saith the Lord, the Lord and thy God that pleadeth unto the cause of his people, behold, I will take out of thine hand the cup of trembling, even the dregs of the cup of my fury. Thou shalt no more drink it again, but I will put it in the hand of them that afflict thee. Zechariah 12:7-9. The Lord shall save the tents of Judah first. And Zechariah 12:3, we've already read. Jeremiah 30:11, for I am with thee, saith the Lord, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. And take a look at the context of Zechariah 14:6-16. He talks about the destruction of nations there. And at the end, in verse 16, he says, and it shall come to pass that every one that is left of all the nations, showing how thoroughly that destruction will occur, everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall then even go up year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. We hope that this little brief history lesson will help us appreciate the progress of the establishment of the kingdom in our present day. Israel now abides in their land. They possess the city. They possess the West Bank, even though there's a lot of negotiation and trouble going on at that in that area. And we'll have to address any other prophecies at another time.
Thank you, Brother Dan, and for that wonderful history lesson on Israel. We can see God's hand in all of it, can't we? It's not just ancient Israel in the Old Testament, it's the prophecies that are being fulfilled as we speak, so we appreciate that. And we're going to close with the last two verses of hymn 317.